Welcome back to the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Beadratty. Beadratty's got some of the best assortment of golf clothes on the market. They are our favorite brand, and we have some polos of theirs in our pro shop. One of my favorites, what I'm wearing actually right now, is the Tommy Polo. It is a classic but bold stripe polo, and of course it's made from that soft Peruvian cotton that Beadratty is known for. It's soft, but it's got a little bit of stretch. So it's low maintenance, easy to wash, easy to wear. It's very versatile. You can wear it on, off the golf course, and it's got a Fried Egg logo on it. So if you want to support us and Beadratty, a company that we really respect and think they're a great part of the golf world, visit our pro shop, thefriedegg.com. Click the pro shop in the top corner and get yourself a new polo with the egg logo right on the pocket. Today's episode is with Walker Cup captain Nathaniel Crosby. Nathaniel was the captain in 2019 when the U.S. won the Walker Cup, and he will be the captain in 2021 at Seminole, where he's a member. So we quickly talk about the match that was there, the Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, Matthew Wolf match, and then we dive into some of his playing career on the European Tour, and then we talk about the 2021 Walker Cup. So without further ado, here's Nathaniel Crosby.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
I'm just thinking about that era, and you know, you had Adams, you guys at Orlemar, and then not too far later, you had Sonar Tech all kind of come in and become this in vogue must have fairway wood. Was there something about fairway woods that allowed for entry easier than any other point with golf clubs?
Well, I give you a very I'll give you another quick one of my golf manufacturing experience, which has now been suspended for 15 or so years because I haven't been in the business for almost 20 years now, but I do follow it. The history of the tour count by storekeeping unit is the same percentage, is a mere percentage of the market share. So when Ping started to dominate on the PGA Tour, and they had 60% of the players or 45% of the players or whatever it was, and used Ping putters, the market share was exactly the same. Titleist golf ball since the 50s, right? It's the count, the market share, and, you know, is the same as the count. You know, 70% of the touring pros, it's the same deal all the way through, all the way to Fairway Woods. And we outsold Callaway by storekeeping unit. We didn't outsell them by brand, but we outsold Callaway by, you know, if you're talking about the Tri-Metal versus Callaway, you know, any one storekeeping unit of Callaway that was a fairway wood, we outsold them because they, in 1998 and 9. So, you know, I think the big thing what we did as a category is Adams really came out first, but they didn't commit to the PGA Tour. And they had a few guys on the senior tour playing it, but they created that shallow wood. And my whole feeling about, you know, any product is if it's different and it's better and it's a better product for a significant part of the market. Doesn't have to be all the market. Could be 30% of the market. Could be 40% of the market. But if it's a better product for part of the market that's significant enough, then you can really capture some market share. And the shallow face woods were, you know, people were hitting them further because you could have lower loft and get them in the air. So instead of a 15 degree three wood, you were hitting a 13 degree three wood. Or, you know, instead of a four wood at 19 degrees, you're hitting a 17 degree four wood. So you're just hitting it further. But it did have some negatives, and people topped them if they tried to swing up on them. Mm-hmm. They had to kind of hit them like an iron. And, you know, I always used to present it by saying it was a vertical margin of error that wasn't as great as a deeper, you know, the vertical margin of error wasn't as good. So if you chopped down on it in the rough, you'd fluff it. You'd hit right under it. But you could hit it out of kind of nasty, you know, if in the short rough, you could bomb it out of the short rough.
Oh yeah. Those things, you know, went so far.
You just had to keep it. I mean, I was a different player because I was 35 or 38 years old then. I could still had a reasonable back, but I remember hitting that, that 11 degree, I could hit that 255 or 60 yards and off the ground. And that was just a game changer for me. And, you know, the 13 degree was, you know, maybe 10 yards less, but, you know, you could get an 11 degree fairway wood up in the air and you could have it, you know, you could hold par fives with it. And for the average play, you know, I was like playing with my partner at the Cravens, my Orlemar co-chairman, Ed Dolinar at the Cravens. And I was looking at him trying to, he's a pretty average player, about a 10 or 12 handicap. And I was like, man, am I glad he's using that on Orlemar tri-metal as opposed to a traditional, because just an awkward lie or a thin lie, you could still nail those Orlemars. And, you know, it's just the golf manufacturing business is a hard business. And I just felt like, you know, I grew two companies and missed the ring on both of them. So I'm still pissed, you know, because I succeeded in a really hard category and really didn't get the windfall because, you know, I think Orlemar, we went from 115 million in 99 and lost control of the company. And I was stayed on the board for another year and a half and just couldn't handle the direction. They were trying to under-promise and over-deliver.
Young companies are just a crazy atmosphere, and there's so much stuff that goes on. And I think you alluded to here the line was so thin. You know, talking some golf. I mean, we got to see our first live golf yesterday. I assume you tuned in to Seminole, where we're going to be having the Walker Cup next year. What were your thoughts on yesterday's match?
I just thought it was fantastic, you know, to see Seminole on TV and, you know, the drone videos were just, you made the course look so beautiful, exquisite. And, you know, I love the mystery of Seminole. I love the fact that I'm mixed in with a bunch of old other retired champions. And we're mixed in with these masters of the universe that have, you know, really, you know, titans of industry. And we all get along great. It's a great chemistry that really Barry Van Gerwig, I think there had been a little bit of that before, but Barry Van Gerwig really ushered in the old retired champions to mix in. Billy Joe Patton, I think, was a member here and, you know, former Walker Cupper, but and captain, I think. And we had so many, but it was just a little bit. Barry Van Gerwig really allowed me to be a part of the club and, you know, ushered in Downing Gray and Vinnie Giles and Spider Miller, Mike McCoy, you know, Buddy Marucci, just goes on and on. I know I'm going to leave out some, but, you know, Gene Elliott now is, you know, a great amateur golfer. And we all have a blast together. We all love playing. Dick Sideroff's one of my best buddies. I love to handpick old crotchety guys, so I love Dick Sideroff to death, who won the British Amateur a couple of times, and I think he played in 10 or 12 Masters. So we have a blast together there. And you know, Dick will be playing with Ken Langone, or you know, you go out there and you know. get paired with, you know, Tom Ryan or Ed Hurley or Jimmy Dunn or all these guys that are absolute champions of industry.
Yeah, it's obviously an incredible place. How did you feel the course held up? I know there's a lot of people. I think most of the pros that have played there knew that it wasn't a pushover, but you know, I saw some pundits were saying that it might be, you know, it might get eaten alive, but you know, even with the rain, it seemed like it held up pretty well.
Well, I think it really held up well, and Hal Hicks, the Seminole greenskeeper, really did a great job. But you know, when it rained 3 inches in 2 days before, and collectively 3 inches in the 2 days prior, that the firmness of the greens and the wind is really the number one defense on that golf course, because the greens, you know, slope to the sides, and if you work your ball with the wind at all, the ball will roll 80 feet across the green and go into the water. So you really have to bank your ball against the wind. You got a right to left wind, you better fade it. You have a left to right wind, you better draw it. And you better have that ball coming down, hitting the green when it lands straight. You know, it can't be coming in on an angle or it just rolls out. And I think that was missing a little bit yesterday because the greens were so soft. And, you know, the course, the fairways were soft, so they weren't running. There's just nothing that could be done about that. You can't get out there with a blow dryer, you know. So, but I think the targets are so hard to hit, and I think the course held up pretty darn well, considering. I think it would have been perhaps more intriguing if the wind was blowing and the greens were firm.
What you were talking about there with the banking, do you feel, you know, obviously Ben Hogan's famous for talking about it. If you can play Seminole, you can play anywhere. Is that the essence of Seminole that you think he was talking about, where the idea of you having to be able to control your trajectory in so many different ways to find the greens?
I think then it was a longer course for, you know, for Ben Hogan, but it was also a much firmer fairway. The fairways were firmer, from what I understand. You know, depending on the time of the year, when Claude Harmon shot a 60, I only know about this, you know, Tony Pena said that they had a drought that year and it was a pitch and putt course. And Claude Harmon used to say, yeah, he says, they talk about my 60 all the time, but they don't tell that I shot 63 the next day.
Wow.
You know? So he shot 123 in 2 days. And I know about it because I used to spend countless hours with Tony Pena, who was playing with him. But I think, you know, when Barry Van Gerwijk took over, he made a strategic, you know, a philosophical difference with the course. I think the ball was going further. This was in the early 90s. You know, it really didn't take the big jump until the Pro VX and the, well, whenever that was, 2004 or 5. When the Pro VX came out, but the guys are getting bigger, everybody's getting stronger. So it's impossible to lengthen the course more than they really have on a hole. Like 14 is really a par four for those guys. 15 is really a par four for those guys. Although they can move the tees back a little bit, it's still a par four for the most part, a hard one, but still, you know, 14 and 15 are pretty easy par fives for those guys. You know, the seventh hole, which is a long hole for the members, is, you know, those guys were hitting it right to the lake. They're worried, you know, they were flipping it to the lake because there's nowhere that they can move the tee back. But when Barry Van Gerwijk came in, he, you know, the greens were always soft. And I enjoyed the greens being soft because you could shoot at a corner pin placement and, you know, you could get results. But the course now, especially with the bunkering, the fairway bunkering, when Corin Crenshaw came in, they put lips on those bunkers. The bunkers were very benign. The fairway bunkers were benign. The greenside bunkers have always been monsters, but the fairway bunkers were very benign. You hit it in a fairway bunker, it wasn't a big deal, and the ball would roll through the fairway bunker if you hit it at the fairway bunker with enough strength. Now the ball just hits the lip of the bunker and stays, not only stays in it, chances are it'll half bury under the lip. So, you know, I think that the greens being firm and fast, as opposed to, you know, a couple of points slower and soft, which was what it was during the Coleman era and the Allan Ryan era, you know, have made the actual green sizes about half of what they used to be. The green sizes are the same, but because they're firm and fast, you know, they're rolling at 12 or whatever during tournaments, and they're firm, so the targets are literally half of what they used to be, and you better hit the ball against the wind, curve it. You have to curve it against the wind, and you really can't shoot at too many pins.
Yeah. So I got to ask you, after you, you won the USAM in 81 and you played professional golf for a little while, and, you were on the European tour in the mid 80s. And I just would love to hear, I mean, such a drastically different tour then than what, you know, professional golf is now, if you had any stories from the road there.
Well, I got a lot of stories, but, I got some great stories, but, you know, I went through the tour school over there. I missed it over here. And my first year wasn't too bad. I was 87th on the money list and had a good chance to win the last tournament, which was the Portuguese Open, where I was tied with Seve with five holes to play. And he made a double bogey. I made a bogey. And Warren Humphreys won his only tournament in 20 years on the European Tour, who's now the he's now, I believe, on the Golf Channel for the European Tour. But at any rate, you know, I had plentiful stories, but the overview is that I was 87th on the money list my first year, you know, 115th, I think, the second year, and 155th the third. So as they say on Wall Street, I was negative trending. Yeah. But, you know, I got some great friends. All the guys that are on the TV are all my big buddies. Robert Lee, you know, Mark Rowe, Tony Johnston, Richard Boxall. These guys are all on the European TV for the Golf Channel. And I just had a blast making European friends. And, you know, Christy O'Connor Jr., all the Irish guys were great friends of mine. You know, I think Jaime Gonzalez, the Brazilian, was one of my very good friends, and he's buying a bottle of perfume. He was a lifelong, I believe, bachelor, and he was then about 29 years old, and I'm 24 or 5, and I see him buying a bottle of perfume in the duty free in Paris, and I was like, Jaime, who are you buying that bottle of perfume for? And Jaime says to me, he says, Nathaniel, you know, I buy this bottle of perfume for a girl I have yet to meet. And the other funny story is John Bland, the old crusty, one of my favorite people in the world, he's a crusty old dude who was really a talented player. I mean, he could really play South African. And I'd play practice rounds with him once in a while. He was probably about 39 or 40, and I was 24 or 5. And I showed up one day to the practice green before our practice round. And he's putting, and he looks up and sees me and greets me, and he says, Nathaniel, he says, good to see you, my boy. I'm looking forward to today. He says, I wondered what you... I bought theater tickets for you for Saturday and Sunday because I know you won't be making the cut. So,
a little psychological warfare.
Those guys would definitely take the piss out of you. They were so much fun. But, you know, Seve was, I got to know Seve, played with him in the British Open at Troon in 82. And, you know, we had the stars, if you remember. We had... When I played over there, I got paired. Sorry about the background there. We had Seve as number one player in the world. We had Langer 1 year as number one player in the world. And Faldo, Lyle, Woosnam. Oh, shoot, really hung up. Okay. And I played with Elizabeth after his rookie year was my second. And because I played well my first year, or I was probably second or third out of the tour school in the highest, you know, as far as the money list. And they paired me with Eliza Bell five times, I think. So I played 10 rounds of golf with him in 86. You know, so I paired with him a bunch. Colin Montgomery, I played with him in his first round as a pro at Hogs Castle in Scotland at the Scottish Open. We had a bunch of guys, and the guys that people didn't know that could really play. I mean, all those Spaniards could really, I mean, Canizares and, you know, Pinero, trying to think of, the Rivera could really play, and the Irish guys with Damon Darcy and Des Smith almost won the British Open at 49 years old. People don't know, but Mark McNulty, and these guys could really play, and nobody really knew them. But we really had the stars, and then they were only giving three spots on the European Tour to the Masters, and that was a big whine, because then they opened it up at the expense of the amateurs. The Masters really opened it up in about 1988, I think. And right away, I mean, look at all the Europeans that have won the Masters. It's just amazing.
It was the era where all the star power, because the OWGR came out right around then, and there wasn't an American that got to number one until Couples did in 93. You know, all the star power was international at that point.
Oh, Greg Norman was playing over there too.
Yeah.
I mean, Greg would split his time between the two tours, but he was a European Tour member.
Nick Price,
and,
too.
You know, so Greg was, you know, when I was 87th on the money list, I was behind all those guys. So I didn't feel like I did too bad, but I think looking back as a player, I did pretty well as an amateur other than the amateur too. I was third ranked. I mean, Golf Digest ranked 10 players. So I was number three in 81 and number three in 82. And then I didn't end on a high note. You know, I didn't play great. I didn't really play any tournaments before I turned pro. Tried to play the amateur one last time, but in 84, but didn't really end on a high note. And then I think looking back, I don't have any misgivings about retiring too soon or quitting at 26 or 7 years old, whatever I was. I think it was 20, just turned 27, but 26, I think it just turned 26. And you know, the thing about it is I recognized it was just going to be a hard career. It was going to be, I could have maybe stayed out there and gotten my tour card and played well. But, you know, I think when you look at these guys, they're just, some guys are better athletes than others. And I was lucky enough to have dinner with Tom Weisskopf in December. And I told him this, I said, you know, you're a 0.001% athlete, right? And I'm probably a top 3 or 4% athlete. You know, I'm a good athlete, but, you know, to be a top, you know, you're not having fun unless you're in the top 30 or 50. And back then you had to be in the top 30 or 50 to be making any kind of a living. And I just think that there's so many good athletes then and now. And these guys that, you know, were athletic. I mean, you know, the athleticism is underrated, I think. I think these guys are just such good athletes. Because you see so many different types of swing. Even my Walker Cup players. My Walker Cup players, I'm going through, I'm building a picture book for the guys right now. And a lot of action. I hired Brian Morgan, the Scottish photographer, and he took 2,000 images. So this thing is a marathon to put together. But, you know, the guys swing so differently. Cole Hammer swings so differently than Stephen Fisk and Isaiah Celinda and Brandon Wu, and they all swing so differently. They're all low through the ball, you know, and the same thing on the, you know, look at the leading guys on the PGA. Look at yesterday. I mean, Matt Wolf, and when they dissected, you know, Ricky Fowler's flat, you know, he's got a flat swing that's slightly laid off. And, you know, then you got Rory that's got a picture perfect form, and, you know, they're all so different. You know, Dustin Johnson so shut, and you know, how can it be? But it's just like, I'll bet you Dustin Johnson could have played baseball. I bet Rory could have played baseball. I bet they could have, you know, Dustin Johnson could have played basketball. Sure. You know, and Matt Wolf, these guys are total athletes.
It's an interesting thing. I was going to ask you what you thought, you know, the difference between someone like you and I don't think many people would look at Colin Montgomery and scream athlete, but there is tremendous athletic ability required to hit a golf ball as consistently and to generate the speed.
I mean, he really had the last extremely upright swing, you know, but I would bet you there's some athleticism in his genes, you know, because that's a different swing too. And it's just, it's how easy the game is, you know, how easy is it for somebody to repeat their swing? And, you know, when you're, you know, when Jack Nicklaus describes his one iron that he hit on the 17th hole in the U.S. Open in 1972, you know, he felt like he was a little shut and he, you know, at the top of the swing and he made an adjustment. You gotta, I mean, are you kidding me? make an adjustment on a 235 yard shot, you know, when you're leading the U.S. Open and you hit the pin with a one iron, you know, that's incredible instinct, incredible athleticism, to be able to do that. Whether you, you know, whatever you do, arch your, you know, whatever his adjustment was, he arched his back more, or he, you know, stayed down the line more, whatever his adjustment was, you know, was his secret. But, you know, and then you look at, you know, Hogan did it with technique, because Tony Pena used to tell me that he really wasn't that great a player until he changed his, he used to swing long and have a, he used to fight a bad hook. And then he changed his grip to where he knew he could never hook the ball. So he did it with technique, but underneath it all, he was a good, you know, he's a beautiful athlete, you know? So, you know, I think that obviously chipping and putting and nerve has a lot to do with it as well. And that has a lot to do with confidence, but boy, sure looks like a lot of golf holes are easier for Dustin Johnson than a lot of other people, you know, and he can bomb it that way. And this guy, Matt Wolf, is the same. I was lucky enough to have him in my practice squad last year, or a year and a half ago, where he played Seminole. We played Seminole twice, and then played MacArthur twice, or Medalist MacArthur, and then Bears Club twice. So I had him for six rounds. And, you know, this guy is totally the real deal. He hits at 330, and as you saw yesterday, he's a bomber, and he knows his golf swing. He's great. He's going to win a lot.
Yeah, you had Colin Morikawa in that also, right?
I haven't watched Colin Morikawa because I knew that he was going to turn pro before I might have seen him at the U.S. Amateur a few holes when I'm trying to think of who he played, but I'd missed Justin Soo and Colin Morikawa, who declined the practice squad thing because he knew he was going to turn pro after the NC2A, and Matt Wolf and a couple of other guys were still considering playing the Walker Cup, but took the practice squad matches.
Was there anybody else that, you know, that obviously playing a Walker Cup, you're extraordinarily talented and even be considered. Was there any of the other guy that just like wowed you, like in the sense of Wolf, where you knew he was good, but you didn't know he was that good?
I got to say that all 10 of the players that were on the team, there was no favorite. It was, you know, my whole, you know, I didn't say, you know, even, you know, you, just theoretically, I kind of said, you know, Andy Ogletree and John Augenstein had just gotten to the finals of the U.S. Amateur 2 weeks earlier, 3 weeks earlier. So kind of figured you got to play those guys four times and they have the hot hand. You know, Cole Hammer was number one ranked player in the world, and Stephen Fisk had won 9 college tournaments, I think including 6 that year, and finished second in the NC2As. And so I paired those guys together and made sure that they played in both the singles matches. You know, I think Akshay Bhatia probably has the best raw talent of any player I've ever seen. I mean, the guy's got a wingspan that's just amazing. And he being 17 and Stuart Hagestad being the only mid-amateur, I kind of thought that was a good fit. And, You know, I think the other guys, John Pock and Celinda, are getting along great. But I think Brandon Wu and Smalley and Isaiah, and they're all destined to do very well. And I think, you know, Stuart Hagestad, by the way, choosing an amateur path. I think this guy, because he's going to have 15 or more shots of winning a U.S. amateur, I think he's got a very good chance of winning multiple U.S. amateurs. And I'll bet you, I'd be surprised if he doesn't win 4 or 5 mid amateurs, because he is that good. And, you know, he's really impressive. He got to the quarters, I think, of the U.S. amateur last year. And, you know, but
he got Pebble too.
Pebble is the one I was thinking of, not last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pebble, he got to the quarters, and that's the one that I was thinking of. But he, you know, he literally is disappointed when he loses, and, you know, it's been a bad week for him to get to the semifinals of the mid-amateur. You know, I mean, it's a bad week for him. He's pissed. You know, he wants to restart the week when he gets to the semifinals, where basically anybody else who's a mid-amateur would take, you know, being a mid, you know, getting to the semifinals at the beginning of the week. So he is heads and shoulders to me. You know, there's Scott Harvey and Matt Parzali and others, to be sure. And I haven't followed or studied the mid-ams quite as well, but I'll tell you one thing. Stuart Hagestad is not a, we have to take a mid-amateur. He doesn't, you know, there's no, he's a great presence, and he really was a great chaperone as well for you know, the wild child, which there were some on our team, and he was a great chaperone for Akshay, and you know, but I loved each and every one of them. It was just a blast, and you know, it would be hard for me to pick one. I was really impressed with Andy Ogletree and, of course, John Augenstein. I mean, these guys they're all top notch, but just looking at the images, their form and their technique is just amazing. And I think they're all going to go a long ways. I think it's hard to get on tour that, you know, they got so many wrinkles now, and you got a bottleneck with this coronavirus, you know, and, you know, to get on the PGA Tour. Because you got, you know, the guys, they got to be fair to the guys that got through the Corn Ferry last year. And, you know, there's going to be a bottleneck trying to get on the PGA Tour. So it'll be interesting to see what the PGA Tour does and how they adjust their, you know, the eligibility factor on how you, you know, how many guys can be on the tour and the tournaments and, you know, what's going to happen with the Corn Ferry and the upcoming qualifying for the following year.
So approaching being the Walker Cup captain for a second year, so you know, obviously you were last year, and then you're for 2021. Are you approaching it any differently than you did the first time? Is there anything that you learned from?
Well, this last one, I've been able to, you know, I was able to look at the scout the guys for 2 summers, and I generally started it at the NC2As. I didn't really interrupt my life enough to, you know, travel to college tournaments that were regional in nature. So I started my touring at the NC2As and then tried to go in a time warp to the old tournaments that I used to play in, like the Porter Cup and the Transmiss and the Western Amateur and so forth. So it was kind of like a time warp for me. But, you know, this year, a lot of the tournaments have been canceled. The Walker Cup is in May. So I'll only have this summer to really scout the players. NC2As has been canceled. Mm-hmm. And next year's NC2A is after the Walker Cup, the 2 weeks after. So it'll be a much more abbreviated scouting deal. But I that was one of the funnest parts about it for me, was scouting the players and getting to know their families. I think I got to see like Ricky Castillo play, and
he can play, huh?
Yeah, a few of the other players that would be considered because of their, you know, junior careers. So Ricky Castillo to me is, you know, his last summer, his successes last summer, I believe are going to count. And, you know, he was freshman of the year. You know, it'll be interesting to see if some of the guys that were on my team the last time choose to, you know, another year of college golf, because if they choose to play another year of college golf because of the bottleneck, you know, it keeps, you know, it doesn't allow them to have cash. They won't have cash, but they play another year of college golf, and then they can, you know, that would be John Pock, who's a senior at Florida State, and Andy at Georgia Tech, and Ogletree, yeah, and of course, John Augenstein at Vanderbilt. So, you know, I was, if anything, I was a little disappointed that Akshay Bhatia turned pro. I think that he is an incredible, incredible talent. A lot of the European guys have done that. They turn pro at 17. I don't think it was a financial, it might have been a financial decision, but I don't think it was a financial necessity. But I don't know that enough. I don't know enough. But, you know, I kind of wish that he had won 15, 20 college tournaments, which was inevitable for this guy, and had gotten the college life experience and enjoyed, you know, the maturity that that brings and that part of your life. So I was, you know, he kind of got thrown, he threw himself in the deep end right away. And, you know, things are different when you don't, when you're not the center of attention, right? When he showed up at junior tournaments, he was definitely the center of attention. And I watched him win the TaylorMade Rolex junior at PGA by about 7 or 8 shots. And, you know, I've never seen anybody make so many putts. It was amazing. But he's a great, great kid. Great.
Golf becomes so much tougher when it's your job too, you know?
I don't know about that. I think, you know, the thing about golf is that when you show up on the range and you look down the range and you know you're better than 99% of the people there, and the other guy who's on the range can only beat you 1 in 3 times, you don't worry about a double bogey when you make it. You know, it's like, you know, you make a double bogey, it's like, oh, no big deal, I'm going to come back with 3 birdies. When you are in the Masters and you make a double bogey, you're like, holy shit, I hope I don't make another one. You know, it's just a different mental deal when you're looking down the range and you see guys that you're not sure you can beat day in and day out. It's just a different, it's harder to play your own game. I guess that's the easiest way of saying it.
Back to Ricky Castillo. I carry, a good buddy of mine plays the Western AM every year, and I carry for him. And he, a few years ago, I'll never forget, it was at Skokie, and he's paired with this Ricky Castillo, who I think at the time was 15. And we were about 12 holes in. I turned to my buddy. I'm just like, holy shit, this kid could play. And he shot like the most effortless 67 or 66 that day. And I just couldn't, and I've been following him ever since. And it's just, it's not surprising to see him on such an upward trajectory.
Well, speaking of, that's where I saw him at the Western last year at Butler National. And he played that guy, Eric Bay, in the quarters, I think. And he, I think he was par in, he shot 63 and won on the last, so he won one up. These guys shot 63 and 65 on you know, whatever. I think the other player I'm watching, of course, is Davis Thompson, and from Georgia. I saw him. He lost to Akshay in the rain delay at the Jones Cup, but he played fantastic at the Western last year. So I've gotten to see these guys. I got Thegalia, who's going to be highly, he's highly ranked, and Thegalia had a great year at Pepperdine, and I saw him play at the Western last year, and also at the U.S. Amateur at Pebble. So I've seen a lot of these guys. Pearson Cootie, I've seen a bunch. William Mao, I've seen a little bit. So, you know, I'm not unfamiliar with Quade Cummins. I saw at the Western. and he looks fantastic as well. I miss seeing him win the Pacific Coast, but at any rate, so most of the guys that are highly ranked, Trent Phillips is down there too. I've seen him. I haven't seen a few of the others. Thorberson, I saw at the Pebble Beach last year at the Open. So, you know, I've gotten familiar with a bunch of these guys that are currently being considered. Cannon Clay, I think he finished second to Akshay at that Rolex Junior. But at any rate, I'll hopefully get to see, you know, four or five tournaments this summer. I'm hoping to go to the Transmiss, hoping to go to, definitely be going to the U.S. Amateur at Bandon Dunes. And hopefully the Porter Cup, if they don't cancel these events. So I know they've canceled the Pacific Coast already. So it'll be interesting to see if these guys scrub out. Sonny Hanna I'll go to as well. I believe they've postponed it but haven't canceled it. So
Hopefully.
Northeastern unfortunately got canceled. I was looking forward to going up there.
Yeah, hopefully they'll get some of them in. So you get, you know, because obviously college golf is in question next year. So last question, you've been more than generous with your time. I don't want to take too much up. I got to ask about, you know, what it was like growing up in the same neck of the woods as Bobby Clampett as a junior and amateur golfer.
He was about a year or two older than me, but we got paired in the U.S. Junior qualifying and at Stanford in Sharon Heights. And, and then we got paired together at Pacific Coast Junior. So we got paired more than a few times. And I think he was 17 and I was 15 that one summer. And I won a bunch of junior tournaments for my age, but was always losing to Bobby for the overall, you know. So, but he was great. And then we played college golf. He was a Brigham Young for a little bit, and he went to Robert Louis Stevenson High School before he went to Brigham Young. But he was definitely the player. I was playing in that British Open at Troon that he could have won, but you know, he really had it going on, and he had that golf machine thing down perfectly. And was working with Ben Doyle for a long time, and something happened there, is my understanding. Something happened with him and Ben Doyle, and he kind of lost his teacher. And then he tried to change his swing, but boy, I got to say, everybody thought he was the next, you know, Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, whomever, you know, he was going to be the next great player.
How would you say, like, from an amateur resume, how he compared with some of the other greats that you've seen?
Well, I think it's interesting. He won the Spalding tournament as an amateur, which was not a officially recognized tour event, but that was pretty impressive for a 21-year-old amateur to do that. But then you look at Scott Verplank. You know, Scott Verplank won the Western Amateur. Okay. Or won the Western Open. I mean, he won the Western Open as an amateur. And, you know, I think Mickelson did it at Tucson, right?
Yeah.
But
Verplank won the
I don't know that. Scott Verplank won everything twice.
Yeah.
He won if you look at Scott Verplank's record, I don't have it in front of me, but he won the Porter Cup. He won the Western. He won the Western Amateur and Open. He won them all. And, I kind of overlapped. He was a little bit younger than me, but, I got a lot of time with Hal Sutton, got a lot of time with Mark O'Mara. Corey Pavin was my age. So we had a pretty good crop. I mean, I was Scott Hoke, you know, Hal and Scott Hoke were a little bit ahead of me, but I got invited to all these tournaments when I was 17 and 18. So I got John Cook, and I got the class ahead of me because I was getting invited to these tournaments as really young. Yeah. I played well in the junior. I was medalist in the junior. So it kind of justified the invites to these tournaments. I was getting a lot of exposure for my dad's thing. So I was kind of cluttering up the field, finishing in the middle of the pack, and then I started to. I played well in college my freshman year and won, and you know, but and then you know, quarterfinals, this trans miss, and North and South, same thing, and semifinals in the Broadmoor. So I was kind of hanging around, but I hadn't won anything big before the U.S. Amateur. But at any rate, it was great to, you know, to get around all of those guys. And we had a great crop of players for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, it's just always so fascinating to watch, you know, amateur and which ones turn into, you know, great professionals. And it's just such a fine line and so tricky. You know, the difference between a few major wins and a few tour wins is so great, but not really that big when you look at it, when you think about it.
You know, it's just when you look at, you know, Greg Norman having two majors, it's just, you know, I mean, there's some guys that just look so much better than others. And, you know, you kind of see it on the back of the range when you're watching people hit balls. And that's the thing that Akshay is going to have to go through, is like everybody hits it as good or better than he does. It has never happened to him before. He's never been in that kind of an environment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But boy, does that kid certainly has a wingspan. It's a fine line for sure. But the guys that are a little bit better than everybody else, you know, they understand it and they know it. And that's why they go in and week out and perform. And it's easier for the guys that know it to play their own games. And the guys that are, I mean, Tom Lehman didn't really start breaking through until he was 30, 31, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And Hogan was on this. Hogan could have given up. I mean, if he doesn't, you know, make the paycheck in Oakland, you know, he quits. And, you know, his whole career wouldn't have unfolded if he doesn't make that paycheck in Oakland, right? So it's amazing. Hogan didn't win a major until he was 35. So it's amazing how the success happens and when it happens and for what reason. But stable lifestyle is a big part of it, as well as the athleticism and the nerve being the third.
Yeah, for sure. It's it requires all facets to be truly great. But I really appreciate the time, Nathaniel, and look forward to hopefully seeing you out at an amateur tournament this summer. Hopefully that some of these happen, and it'll be fun to watch. You know, maybe I'll have you back on to talk before the next year's Walker Cup.
Fantastic. All right. Look forward to it.